Welcome to the Global Council podcast, where you can hear the GC team discuss and debate topical developments in public policy and regulation from around the world.
On behalf of Global Council, I'd like to welcome you all today and thank you for joining what we anticipate will be a very lively and engaging discussion. I'm Elizabeth Beale, and I lead Global Council's climate and sustainability practice. And I'm honored to introduce you to our featured speaker for today, Lord Deben, who's the chairman of the Committee on Climate Change, among many other laudable roles ranging from chairman of Valpak Limited and Sancroft. He's also the longest serving Secretary of State for the Environment that the UK has ever had, and throughout his career has championed the link between addressing environmental challenges and good business sense. So Lord Deben, thank you for joining us and sure. Welcome. And I'm also honored to introduce you to Geoffrey Norris, Senior Advisor at Global Council. Geoffrey is an expert in climate, energy, and industrial policy, and has been at the heart of business and climate policymaking for the past two decades, having served as a principal business advisor to previous prime ministers. So, Geoffrey.
Thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you, Lord Deben, for joining us. I'd like to start by asking you about the Climate Change Committee. 12 years since its creation, it does seem to me to be an example of successful innovation in public policymaking. It's improved the quality of policy discussion and decision-making in the UK. And at a time of what one might describe as political change in the UK, it's been a point of continuity and durability. What would you identify as the reasons for its success?
Well, I think, first of all, its independence. I think it is remarkable that Parliament was prepared to set up a committee which consists not of representative people, but of scientists and economists, chaired by somebody who is neither, but otherwise without representation, which is very clever, really, because it meant it didn't compete with Parliament in some way. It gave very clear and gives very clear advice based on the science. And so the second thing I think is so important is the fact that the first chairman, Adair Turner, brilliantly recognized that his job was to make sure that everything that was published was accurate, was scientifically correct, and was not campaigning, simply told people what the facts were as far as any of us knew. And that, of course, established the situation, which was that this was neither an NGO campaigning, nor was it an instrument of government, because he upheld the independence very strongly. And then I was fortunate, because when I was appointed, we had a coalition government. So I was appointed by a Liberal Democrat minister, the first Minister of Wales, who was a Labour supporter, first Minister of Scotland, who was a Scots nationalist, and the first Minister of the North of Ireland, who was a Protestant unionist. So the fact that they chose a Catholic and a Conservative was, of course, made quite sure everybody realised it really was independent. And that, again, is a terribly important thing, that this is not something appointed by the Prime Minister. It's actually appointed by these four. And it's very unusual, would be very unusual, for any two of them to belong to the same party. So that, again, really keeps the politics out of it. And then I think the third thing is that the Act is a very clever Act, because it actually lays down timetables. So that, for example, we produced and had to produce the sixth carbon budget in December of last year. The government has got to place it or an alteration of it before Parliament before the beginning of June. It has to do that. Every year, whether we like it or not, we have to produce a report as to how well the government has done, and we have to do that in June. And it doesn't much matter what else is happening, they can have an election or a referendum, do what they like. But the fact is, we have to do that by law. And there is no way of changing that unless you actually have a statutory change. And I think the fourth reason is the remarkable recognition that there were two dates you had to get right. First of all, you have the democratic demand of regular refreshment of mandate. 4 or 5 years, you have to go back to an election. On the other hand, you had the climate change demand, which was a continuation of policy, that you couldn't defeat climate change unless there was a continuation of policy. And that, of course, is a very different timescale from the mandate timescale. And what the Climate Change Act did was to bring those two together so that when a budget is brought forward, as it has by law to be done by the Climate Change Committee, Parliament then votes on it. But once it's voted on it and given it democratic strength and asserted democratic control, after that, it can't change it without the Climate Change Committee agreeing. Now, that's terribly important, because otherwise the whole idea of doing these budgets well in advance would be destroyed. The reason we do it so well in advance, which is my last reason why I think it's been a success, is because doing it well in advance means that they are presented to Parliament at a time in which people can look at the budget pretty objectively. If you're deciding about a budget, as they will be, between which is going to run for most of the 2030s, well, it's quite difficult to get too worried about what Mrs. Jones down the road's factory might do at that stage or what might happen there. It's not about the next election or indeed the election afterwards. So Parliament is much more able to give it an independent view. But overall, of course, the thing that has really made the difference in Britain is that this is a cross-party thing. It was invented by the Conservative Party in opposition. The Conservatives gathered together the support of every other political party in opposition. They then said to the Labour government, we don't want this to be a party political thing. What's more, there are 100 Labour members who will break any whip you put on to support this bill. So why don't you actually put the bill through? And as a result, nobody has the credit for the success. It wouldn't have happened without the Labour government taking it on board. They wouldn't have taken it on board if the opposition hadn't presented it. And all the other parties, including the Protestant Unionists, who do have some members who don't really believe that the Bible entirely supports the theory of climate change, they are all committed to it. So when the bill went through Parliament, it went through with only 8 people voting against it. Same 8 that are still against it. But the truth is, it set us off in a way which is remarkable. And I can honestly say, as chairman, that whoever was in power would be doing much the same things. I mean, I am congratulatory to this government in the sense that it has set a policy program and schema, which is very much to the point. But I think that any party in these circumstances would do very much the same things. And that is a really remarkable thing to be able to say.
Thank you. That was extremely interesting. Can I just ask, so December's report set out what I think is a groundbreaking pathway to net zero. And I think it's a model that other countries will want to look at and will follow, full of lots of analysis and recommendations. Great work by the commissioners, but also great work by Chris and the Secretariat in producing it. One of the things that struck me about it was the interesting analysis on the costs of decarbonisation being less than some people had been suggesting. And I think that was very, very interesting. But what I'd quite like to ask you is, what would be, amongst all of the recommendations, what would be your kind of top line takeaway for people to think about from your from the report?
I think the thing that it really does is to reassure people that we can do it, that we can do it in time, and that we can do it at a cost which we manifestly can bear. Because the naysayers, of course, have moved from saying climate change isn't happening, because that is no longer a possible statement. It was never much of a statement, but it now is impossible. I mean, when gardeners know that that spring is starting 17 days earlier than when they started gardening, I always find that if you speak to a rather older audience, they all know that. They know the world has changed. And if it's changed like that here, think what happens in the equators. So what the naysayers have done is to move to a line which says, of course, it's happening, but really the cost of doing all this is impossible, and it hits the poorest hardest. Many of them are not noted for their support from the poor in the past. And some of people who were in Parliament with me are people who used to argue with me very strongly, because I do have to have a One Nation social conscience, and I must say, listening to some of them, and I think, my goodness me, that's not where you were interested in your political life. But anyway, they now have moved to this price thing. So it was hugely important for us to produce these figures and to produce them with the same degree of accuracy and care that we have done everything else. So actually, nobody's been able to criticize these. They have been very tough. We actually think we can do it cheaper. I mean, if you ask me whether I thought it would be about 1% gross national product a year, I have to say I think that overall it'll be less than that. And of course, it'll be largely paid for by investment by the private sector. And it'll be investment which largely will be necessary to get out of COVID, leave alone anything else. So it all fits well together. But I do think that the great thing is that everybody out there, every single person knows that it can be done. So it's no good saying, well, let's eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die, because actually we don't need to die tomorrow. We can actually do it. And secondly, we can do it by 2050. Now, I know that's controversial because many of the campaigners want us to say we can do it earlier. But again, I've got to be able to assure the public that this is really practical. And the problem with it is that, yeah, it'd be lovely to do it by 2030, be lovely to do it by 2040. But the truth is you have to do it sequentially. You can't make electric cars contribute unless you've got energy which is produced by renewable schemes. By the time you get the electric cars on, you really aren't going to be able to ban every car that isn't electric in 2030. You do have to be sensible about this. So the date is important, and then of course the price is important, because it means that we can do it within any kind of reasonable budget.
On the date, I mean, one of the things I also took from reading the report was that it is a call for action in the next decade, that some big things, big decisions need to be taken in the coming years in order for us to get ready to make real progress. Is that right?
Oh, yes. I mean, the fact that we say we can't do it before 2050 is dependent upon the fact that we also say that we have to do a hell of a lot of things in the next 10 years. Otherwise, we won't get to that. I mean, this is no slowly, slowly catchy monkey. The point is the monkey's got out. That's what climate change has done. It no longer is under our control. So the timing is, in a sense, dictated to us by the fact that we cease to control climate change. So, of course, we have to do a whole series of really tough things during this period. And the government has recognised that, and what the government has announced has certainly comes near to what we think ought to be the policy. The problem, of course, is not the policy, it's the delivery. And it is that we're going to spend the rest of this decade, I have no doubt, on.
Yeah.
It's about getting that policy into delivery.
Delivery is always quite difficult.
It is. The government particularly so. That's not what they know about.
Can I turn to the wider international picture and COP? After the train crash at Copenhagen, Paris and its bottom-up rather than top-down approach was regarded as a real advance. The expectation was that it would steadily ratchet up countries' carbon reduction efforts. Do you think it is actually achieving that?
Well, I think, first of all, we mustn't underestimate the absolute unique nature of Paris. I mean, it is the only time in history that every nation on earth has signed up to a willingness to make common cause. Now, we all know that some of those who signed up have no intention of doing what they said they'd do, and others have promised things which we don't notice that they are doing, and we're going to have to ratchet them all up. But the basis is remarkable. And when you think of, I was at Kyoto, when you think of how difficult Kyoto was just to get anything to move at all. And then I think that the other bit of we often underestimate about Paris was the commitment of the rich nations to recognize they had to pay for it. And that's just a matter of moral justification. It isn't just because they've got the money. It's because that money comes from the very pollution that has actually made the world in peril. So we are rich because we have polluted, and therefore you have to pay the price. There's no way through that. And that is intrinsic. And actually, it was largely the work of Amber Rudd. One must not forget that Britain played a really important part in doing that. Now, the ratcheting has to take place. That's why there is a five-year policy of this. But we also have to remember that America signed up to Paris in a way which she was never able really to sign up to Kyoto. Yeah. But she signed up to Paris, and there was that wonderful picture of John Kerry with his grandchild on his knee when he signed it, because that was the point he was making. Although I keep on reminding people that it's now moving so fast that it's not our grandchildren we're looking after, nor our children. Even people as old as I am are looking after me, because this is really changing quickly. But the fact is that America has been out of the world for 4 years. It's very difficult for Americans to recognize just how absolutely otherworldly the Trump regime was, that it had nothing to do with the realities of life. And the coming of Joe Biden is really very important, not least because he's not a radical. What he is something much more important, actually. He is a realist. And what he's talking about is the realities of life. So he's going to have difficulty from what you might call his radical wing. But the truth is that as far as America is concerned, what he's doing is calling the nation back to a real approach to the world. And that is hugely important for the rest of us, because it does mean now that almost all the industrialized nations have now signed up to net zero in 2050. I mean, China wants it to be 2060, but at least she signed up. I mean, who would have thought that Japan would sign up to net zero at 20, or South Korea? So the world showed the direction it was moving in Paris. And I think now there's every reason to believe that we're going to make that work. The only problem is, and it is a very real problem, is that there are an awful lot of delivery issues in the meantime. And we've also got to be very clear about helping nations to achieve their end. I mean, the point that I'm particularly concerned about is we've got to help the developing nations to move from where they are to where they ought to be without the intervening period of dirty business. That's really the important thing. And that means that we really do have to help Africa, but particularly in Africa, where a huge rise in population, huge demands, and yet it's much more sensible to have for example, radio telephony rather than fixed line. It's similarly much more sensible to have dispersed generation than it is to have centralized generation. All that is true. There's a lot of sun, actually, so you can do a lot with photovoltaics. There's a good deal of wind in some places, so you can do that too. All that can be done, but it needs investment. And of course, there, this government has done two awful things, and one does have to say that. I mean, first of all, the reduction of the overseas aid budget from 0.7 to 0.5% is a moral outrage. I mean, you really, no human family would dream when they were in difficulties of taking it out on people with even less than they did. I mean, I just find it so unacceptable and so unnecessary and marginal. If you really look at what we're spending on COVID, it's really a very serious issue. And of course, that has set us back as far as other things are concerned, because we had committed ourselves to it. The Conservative Party, I don't just mean we as a nation, but the Conservative Party, now the government, had in their election manifesto committed themselves to that. So of course, that has undermined us very seriously. And then secondly, was the sort of raid by the Foreign Office of the Bayes-based money for the climate change. Now, the climate change budget has not been changed. It is what it was. That is, thank God, very at least good. But it's now being run by the Foreign Office. And the thing about this is that this is not their expertise. And it was done for reasons which are quite difficult to see, except a bit of empire building, it seems to me. And it's a really serious issue. Because Bayes had got the thing running really very effectively. And there are some pretty difficult signs that the Foreign Office hasn't really seen the particularly careful balance that you have to do here. And those who were running it ought to be running it too now.
Can I ask you, what, in your mind, does success at COP26 look like?
Sorry, success, what does it look like? Well, I think obviously that the nations already commit themselves to something more and show that they have a program to do so. Now, we've led well on that. I allow myself to be very critical when it needs to be, because I can be complimentary then. And the government taking the figure which we recommended of saying that by 2030 it will reduce our emissions on 1990 by 68% has in fact done something which is really important. First of all, it's more than anyone else. But secondly, it's what you have to do if you're going to get to 2050. And that's why, as you said, the sixth carbon budget is a groundbreaking budget, because it does take you, in effect, to 2050. Because by the time you get to the end of the 30s, you can draw a straight line from that to the 50s. If you aren't there then, you're not going to reach the other. So the government set a very good example on that. Other nations are beginning to recognise that they really do have to work through it. They can't say a figure for 2030, which makes 2050 impossible, if they've committed themselves to net zero in 2050. So I think that is part of the measurement. The money actually not only being promised but delivered for the developing countries is going to be a really important part of it. And better mechanisms for measurement, better ways of thinking about offsetting, all those things are going to be things we'll be looking at. I mean, if you take the issue of offsetting, there are ways in which you can use offsetting, which will actually help poorer countries to get to their end quicker. But there are other ways in which you're just getting out of doing it yourself, and that isn't an acceptable thing as well. So
the reason why the Climate Change Committee is not that keen on the UK taking some of the counting some of these offsets in its own target.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be quite wrong for us to do that. I mean, if you want to, there's a perfectly good argument to say that part of your spending on helping people to fight climate change elsewhere might be spent in a way which actually was linked with offsetting. But that would be an addition. That's an addition to it. We have to do this ourselves. We really cannot run a society in which we are forever dependent on other countries not doing things, because of course you then run against the buffers, because by the time you get towards the ends of the 2030s, what is happening? These other countries are also doing what you want to do, and therefore the cost of that offsetting, if that's what you wanted to do, becomes greater. And so putting it off always seems to me to be the fundamental thing the Climate Change Act sought to avoid. It sought to make sure that politicians did today what needed to be done today and didn't put it off to tomorrow because there was an election, because the particular prime minister didn't like it, because the minister for this had a constituency interest on that. The whole concept is that you do now what you've got to do and you can't put it off.
On politicians, I'm conscious of time. On politicians, I wanted to turn to politicians, voters, voters and citizens. Now, the next stage of the journey to net zero is going to intrude on people's lives in a way that decarbonizing power generation hasn't. So it's going to impact on the way we heat our homes, the vehicles we drive, possibly what it is we eat. Public support, engagement, consent for decarbonisation is going to be absolutely vital for it to succeed and for it to stick. Now, encouragingly, my old boss Tony Blair's think tank recently produced a report which shows high levels of concern in the electorate about climate change. That's true across demographics, the age groups, class, urban versus rural. And also it shows that people are putting increasing salience on tackling climate change in the way that they look at politicians and politics. But the Tony Blair Institute report also struck a cautionary note. And to paraphrase, they warn of a risk of pushback by some people against what can be caricatured as experts telling us to give things up and how to live our lives. Now, do you think this is a real threat, or do you think it's exaggerated? And if it is a real threat, that there's a kind of political backlash against climate change, what is the best way for us to mitigate that and to address it?
Well, first of all, I think we have to take it as a real threat, because we've seen throughout the democratic world an increasing suspicion of experts. It's the only explanation of the nation shooting itself in the foot by voting for Brexit. I mean, nobody sensible would have done that, and they've done it, and that is a very clear example. And the reason they did it was, in very many ways, they've just felt that a lot of people have been left behind, and there were these clever people who were telling them what to do. I mean, that was the Farage way of presenting things. Amazing how he managed to pretend that he was somehow or other a working class, a poor person standing up for them, but he did. So we have to recognize in the United States the long history of anti-intellectualism, which has been a characteristic of American politics, I mean, for 150 years at least, came to its absolute apogee with Mr. Trump. Now, the reason for it is one that is continuing. I mean, it is continuing that large numbers of people find the speed with which change is taking place very difficult to cope with. So the first thing that happens is that an awful lot of the old signposts aren't there any longer. So the man who said to me, to a friend of mine, when he explained why he was voting to leave the European Union, he said it's because the vicar's gay. Now, the connection between these two is very obvious. It is that the old things that he could rely on have been removed. And this was the first opportunity he had to say, I don't like this. And there are a lot of people who feel that a lot of things that are happening, they don't like. And they don't necessarily intellectualize them, but they feel very strong. Now, it's all too easy for that situation to become one in which people telling them that climate change is really going to affect them and asking them to do things they don't particularly like could have a blowback. So I've noticed that now. I mean, they've got articles in certain newspapers of a kind, which we all understand, saying it's all the sort of comfortably off and intellectuals saying these things and pointing very often at me and saying it's all right for him. He's got an air source heat pump. But now, you know, so he's able to pay for that by forcing it on other people. So we have to recognise that is very likely. And so there are three things we have to do. First of all, we have to have a just transition. And that's why we asked the Treasury to produce a report on how we had a just transition, because so far, of course, some of the poorest have paid more than they should. For example, the way that we charge for electricity, which is not the right way to do. And the second thing you have to do is to be much better at talking about it in language which people understand. So I banned the phrase, for example, kilowatt hour from the Climate Change Committee because I don't know what it means. I can't see it, I can't feel it, and I don't know whether it's big or small or what. I've got to talk about bills. I mean, what are people paying? Then you start to talk about something which they understand. And the third thing I think we have to do is to recognise that we're going to ask particular communities to bear burdens which are specific to them. So if you take this famous coal mine, the truth is you can't have a coal mine which has got planning permission till 2047 when you know that after 2035-6, you're not going to be able to use that coal without carbon capture and storage. I mean, that's untruthful in the system, so you can't do that. On the other hand, it is a much needed jobs in a very underprivileged part of the country. And it seems to me that what the government should be doing is saying, we are going to have to say that you can't have the coal mine, but why is the next nuclear power station not going there, for example? I mean, I'm taking that we've got to be sensitive about these things. And I don't care much about vague phrases like levelling up and northern powerhouses and the rest of it. What I care about is if you can't have 2,000 jobs here, you've got to find a way of the green economy actually providing jobs, not in general, but in particular. And it's that issue which I think we've got to deal with if people are going to take this seriously. Otherwise, what happens is they're in favour of action in general and against it in particular, which is always a recipe for disaster.
Very powerful point. Elizabeth, I think we're going to do some questions from our listeners. Is that right?
Yes. We have one that I'll take first, which is related to COP26 and whether it matters if COP26 is delayed again. So I think this is picking up on the fact that it's already been delayed a year and, you know, potential that it could be delayed again this year. Does it matter? Is it important?
Well, I think it matters psychologically, because if we don't move, people will begin to think that the urgency which is there isn't there because we've been putting it off again. So I think there is a fundamental reason why it should be. But in the sense, it isn't in our hands, is it? I mean, you could imagine having a rather more limited COP with the key people in it. I don't think that would be as valuable, because I think that the pressure of all those people around and the atmosphere and the rest of it was very important in Paris. And it'll be difficult to reproduce that in a narrower group. But then none of us know what's going to happen. I mean, Britain may find itself in the rare position of being better off on these things than other countries. We may have a new variety, which means that we're in the worse off. How do we know? What I hope is that it will be good enough for us to have more or less the COP which we really want to have, and to have it in November. The fact that it's been put off for a year, I think, has been extremely good, because I don't think this government would have been anywhere near what it is now, nor would it have grasped the nettle in the way that it has now. And I mean, it is exciting, you know. I mean, there are some ministers who clearly aren't really quite up to the whole thing so far, but I'm not sure that's not more generally true. But the fact is, there is a real issue here that they. But there are others who are remarkable. I mean, I think that Kwasi Kwarteng has taken this up and run with it in a real way. The Prime Minister is actually chairing these meetings and is actually clearly committed to it. And with all the things I know not to be perhaps his best opponent, but he has actually done that. And you look at the kind of way in which the Treasury has changed. I mean, I used to think the Treasury was my most difficult department. I think it's in a sense, my most easy department, because they've understood it. They know where they are. And Rishi has certainly been really remarkable. So there are some really good signs, which we wouldn't have had last November. But I don't think we can put it off again if we can possibly help it.
Definitely. Well, and we've talked a little bit about kilowatt hours or not to talk about them. There's a question about another sector, so the food and agriculture sector. So the fact that there's been attention from the Prime Minister on energy efficiency, renewables, et cetera, but nothing yet on changing diets or the role of agriculture specifically. So the question is, do you think the government is willfully ignoring food? Why? And are you hopeful for the national food strategy?
Well, the National Food Strategy and Henry Dimbleby's work on that will be very important, and every sign is that it will be radical in a way which people haven't really quite understood. The last time I talked to him, it was clearly it's going to be a very interesting challenge to the government. I think we've got to be a bit careful about this. Things have to be done in order. The truth is that getting carbon neutral energy was a crucially first step. I think that land use is the most difficult and the most ongoing, continuing thing that we're going to have to deal with. It's a question of recovering the way that soil has lost its fertility. It's a question of soil sequestration as a result. And it's also a question of planting trees. And it is also a question of people eating less meat, but as I say, always better meat. I mean, we want meat grown on pasture land and not by food lots, and that would make a huge difference. And we know a lot more now about how you feed animals in a way which reduces their belching. Just remind people that the real problem is the belch rather than anything else, and that's what they have to deal with. But I'm not sure that, this has all got to be done and got to be done rapidly. But steps have been taken, which I don't think people notice. We 4 years ago, I stopped the Climate Change Committee doing part of its report because there were no figures. And so what it was saying about agriculture was entirely based on anecdotal evidence. And that was against, in my view, what should be done. But now DEFRA has got proper baselines and you can actually measure things, and that will make a huge difference. But it's going to be very big. The thing we have to remember is this great comment by the Pope in the Laudato Si, that absolutely crucial element in this whole story. 6 years ago now, it seems almost impossible to think that, but there it was. And when he said climate change is the symptom of what we've done to the world, I think it's a very useful way of thinking of it, because it means that you cannot solve climate change without looking at all those other things about biodiversity, about land use, about soil quality, all those things we have actually got to face. And I think the order in which they're done is slightly different. But the 20% reduction in meat eating, which we have recommended seems to me something which the public's actually doing itself anyway. I mean, I'm not sure that we always have to think that government does these things, but I just notice it with my own children. I notice it with the way in which friends were. I mean, I'm a huge in very, very committed carnivore, but I am eating less meat, and we do make sure that we don't eat it twice a day, and we really do have days in which we eat these. And what's more, the vegetarian food is now edible. I mean, some of it is really very good. So we're beginning to meet those issues. I'm sorry, we're beginning to go to those issues. So I'm not so sure that we're not going to achieve that without a lot of government intervention. We mustn't, of course, mix that with the intervention which government no doubt will have to do about obesity, because it's not just that we ought to eat less meat, we ought to just eat less, which is a really important issue, but not one happily that I have to deal with.
Right. Well, yes, captured a lot of issues there. Another one is on carbon taxes and whether there's been enough attention on carbon border taxes, the carbon border adjustment mechanisms. Is that receiving enough attention in the UK and internationally? So we've heard a lot in the EU, but should it be getting attention as well elsewhere?
Well, it's obviously going to be true that as the world tackles this whole issue, it's not going to be possible for people to opt out and benefit from the opting out. So, for example, if, and the EU has, I think, done very well on this in its negotiations with Brazil, in saying, look, I'm very sorry, but if you go on destroying the rainforest, you're not going to have a free trade. We're not going to have that kind of trading arrangement. We can't do that. Well, that will become more and more true, that if people don't have some activity of this, then what you will charge them for is the price that they are exacting from you by being able to sell cheaper because they haven't done the things at home. That's what you will do. But it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's quite difficult in the World Trade Association organization umbrella. It's quite difficult to do. And so we ourselves have got to get to a position in which we can properly do it. You can only really do it when you're showing that you yourself are actually imposing at home the measures that are necessary. And of course, that's why I've been very strong in my comments about international trade. That's why I don't think that it's possible to do free trade agreements with countries that don't have the same safety, the same food safety and carbon attitudes that we do. And it's no good. The fact that we have failed to get the government to put that in law, but we have got it to say that it won't do that and we will hold it to that, is a really serious issue. It is no longer possible to treat trade as if it is just a matter of pounds and pence, because it isn't. We don't treat anything else of our society like that. We've learned a long time ago that ESG, even in the toughest kind of investors, are now recognizing that environment, social and governance issues really matter. You can't then say, well, that doesn't count as far as trade's concerned. That seems to me to be pretty balmy and unacceptable.
Definitely. Now we have a question related to the US role and China. So, you know, President Biden's new executive office of climate envoy with John Kerry, what will his role be and how likely is he to be successful at bringing China to the table, like was achieved at COP21? And this is a series of questions in one. How will current tensions with China potentially negatively impact the ambition that's hoped for at COP26?
Well, I think we've got to start off by accepting that John Kerry is a very considerable international figure. You would be very unlikely to find a better person to do this. His work in the past has been that. I've been privileged to know him, and I have already had a long meeting with him. I feel very strongly that we are extremely lucky. He is totally committed to this, but both politically and morally. I mean, you know, he knows it's right, which is a very important part of this. He's also a very good diplomat, and he does understand how to. I mean, he's tough and he's not soft, but he does understand what the priorities are. And of course, China is one of those priorities. China is in a difficult position, both vis-a-vis us and as far as itself is concerned, because it does believe in climate change. There's no doubt at all that the authorities do understand, because they see what it's doing to themselves, and not just because of the appalling pollution in their cities, but also because of the drying up of the water in large areas of China, and the fact that in the same time you have floods. You know, you have both both drought and floods, and that's doing huge danger and damage. And many of the problems that they've got are the result of that, of deforestation, of a whole series of other things that have happened. So again, China has had to learn that the old-fashioned thing of the sort of what I call the Three Gorges attitude, which is that you plonk something down and some huge operation is done and that will deliver, isn't going to work. But at the same time, of course, you know, this is a regime which has now got no easily pointed to authority. I mean, historically, there was the Long March. And if you've been on the Long March, you had this kind of authority. Nobody left that. That's gone. So you're now in power, but your reasons for doing so are much more difficult to argue. So keeping in power is quite hard. And this particular part of the regime has decided that the only way to do that is in a very, very tough and extremely dictatorial manner. But they've also got to live in the world. And the world has to understand that, and they understand that too, and we've got to get better at dealing with them. And one of the things is to have continued and very, very close relationships in every way that we possibly can. And I don't believe in excluding them. You just have to learn to live with and work with, but you have to be very clear about certain things. So I don't think that one can properly behave differently from the way we are behaving in terms of genocide. But we've got to find a way through, and Kerry has understood that.
So maybe as a last question, you had mentioned that you know, part of the argument around how to pay for the cost of climate change and the fact that the private sector will need to take on share of that burden. One of the questions is, you know, what clarity will there be, or should there be, for businesses in terms of making this transition, and what will be the policy direction and clarity from government on the technology transition that is needed?
Well, first of all, the concept of the sixth carbon budget is to give that clarity. You know where we're going to, and you know very much about the program which you have to get through to. Government then has to do an awful lot, and so far on the policy front, I think it has done that. If you look at the motor car issue, I mean, buying an electric motor car is a wholly different activity today from what it was a year ago. Since the government made those changes, almost every motor car company has come forward with the state that they're going to stop building any motor cars except electric ones, because clearly the rest of the world is following Britain. Britain has done the lead in that. It's very important. Took us a lot of doing, the Climate Change Committee. They started, if you remember, under Mr. Grayling, arguing that they couldn't do it any earlier than 2040, and that was enormously good and hard. I remember sitting across at him and telling him it wasn't true. But the fact is, we've got it back to 2035, and then 2033, and then 2030. It's really good. And I do think Grant Shapps, again, is somebody who has taken this issue really seriously and is delivering. So, setting those examples so people know where they are is crucially important. And there's a lot more of that has to be done, particularly in what we have to do about distribution of energy, about the use of the motor car as a storage part of energy, all sorts of things, detail stuff. You know, we've got this ludicrous thing of very, very high-tech offshore wind, but the onshoring of offshore wind is a sort of dad's army operation. It's really awful. We've really got to get these things right. There's a lot to be done. The one thing the government has got to learn is that the good is the enemy of the perfect. I mean, the perfect is the enemy of the good. And they're constantly wanting to change things because it's a bit better if you do it this way. I really do think it's better to be doing the slightly wrong thing, but sticking to it than constantly fiddling about with it. I'm afraid Tony Blair's government, if I may dare say that to Jeffrey, was particularly good at that. But they all follow, they all think that, and it's fiddling at the edges. What we have to recognise is that you want to stick to it. You want, and let's just take, again, comes rather oddly from me, but just watch the Prime Minister's programme for getting out of lockdown is exemplary. I mean, once again today, he said, I'm sticking to this. And you lot that keep on wanting to do things faster or differently, I'm afraid that's not what's going to happen. It's going to happen like this. Now, in a sense, there may be better ways and odd things that could have been done and people being less in discommoded. But the fact is, if you really want people to know where they are and get on, they have to know where they are, and you don't change the dates, and you don't change the bit in the, what the programme is, and you go through that in the way which he has attempted to do on COVID. I think that's what we've got to do on climate change. Then business can afford to invest. Business must know that if it puts money in, and I just end by this, the worst example of how not to do things was the Conservative government in 2017, when they went back on the Labour Party's commitment to net zero homes. Now, we all know the Labour Party's commitment was as far ahead as they could make it, because none of the ministers who made it were likely to be around by then. So let's not be, you know, let's not be naive about this. On the other hand, the Conservative government cancelled that. As a result, we've built 1 million houses which have got to be retrofitted because of that. Now, that means that the house building industry, the nine businesses which control 80% of the house building, have shuffled off their responsibility into the purchasers. So instead of them building a house or a flat which was properly built, they've built crap houses and crap flats, which the people who bought them have now got to put right. I think that's just morally wrong. And it's an example of what happens if you don't stick to your programme. So stick to your programme. People will then invest. And once they are sure of that, then you will get more investment, which is why the two great sins, one was the house fund and the other was the reduction of our money for the developing countries from 0.7 to 0.5, because that undermines people's commitment and their confidence in how you're going to act.
Thank you very much. Huge amount of wisdom and insight from you. That was extremely interesting, including the advice to politicians to stop fiddling. Something with which I agree. thank you very much, and hopefully we'll have another opportunity to talk about these issues again in the future. But for today, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For more insights, blogs and analysis, you can visit our website www.global-council.com and subscribe to our mailing list. And you can follow us on Twitter at global_council.